Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week. All week long, we're asking the question, is this home? This hour, what if home no longer feels like home? During the farm crisis of the 1980s, many Iowa farmers lost their homes. And not just their homes, but their home places. Land that had been in their families for generations. In 1983, Iowa averaged 500 public farm auctions per month. Each one of those farms representing a family that had lost their way of life. Not knowing where else to turn, many farmers wrote letters to then-Iowa Governor Terry Branstad.
June 8th, 1984. Dear Governor Branstad.
Dear Governor.
Dear Mr. Governor.
Dear Governor. The reason I am writing you is the wife and I and three children farm. Our proposal that we sent was rejected by FMHA and the DeWitt
Bank. I'm a farmer, 31, single, trying to make a living on too few acres in Marshall County with my mother. It stormed last night, and the fields are flooded, and my beans are not yet in. I, like so many other farmers in this state, have always accepted the long hours and uncertainties that farming has to offer. This year, I am facing something I don't know how to accept.
Why do Iowa farmers seem worse off than farmers in other states? We do not get less for our products. Our opportunity costs are very little different. I can only conclude it is our unfair tax on farmers. Iowa finally decided to take sales tax off of new equipment after no one could buy any anymore. I know they had to tax cigarettes and candy plus pop to make up the difference. What difference? We were laughing through.
I am a student of Rolfe Community School in Rolfe, Iowa. I'm writing to tell you that I'm very concerned about the farm economy. I am not a son of a farmer, so this problem really doesn't hit close to home. But I have many friends that their mothers and fathers are that are being handicapped by this ordeal. I can see how this is impairing them, so I'm asking you to please look into this situation a little farther.
They said our assets have declined, that we would be a risk. The 300 acres of land we rent, the highest rent being $70 per acre, we feel we can turn the operation from a loss to a profit.
I am not alone. We are in trouble. My neighbors and I, especially the young farmers, without the benefits of inherited lands and monies. There are student
loans. I own 240 acres. I pay $2,400 into the local school district, while someone in the town with a nice home, plus 2 to 3 times the income, pays $300 to $400. Sound fair?
Farming is my profession. The young farmers of this state have never asked for much, but now we need your help or soon there will be no young farmers. You know what Iowa would be without her farmers. Is there anything you can do to help us now? The fields are flooded and my beans are still in their sacks unpaid for. I need help and I need it now. Please, I don't want this to be my last year. Sincerely, John Beam.
Iowa State University historian Pamela Reine-Kerberg has been reading through those letters to Governor Branstad, boxes of letters to the governor from farmers and farm families as part of her research into the farm crisis. In a few minutes, I'll talk with her and Iowa State University sociologist Paul Lasley. But first, George Naylor is a farmer who lives near Tredan, Iowa, on his family's Century Farm. The farm crisis turned him into an advocate and an activist for farmers. He's a board member of the Family Farm Defenders, and he's with me now. Hello, George.
Yeah, hi, Charity.
Thank you for being here. Now, back in the day, you went off to California for school, but you came back to Iowa to take over the family farm in 1976. And the seeds of the farm crisis were really being sown at that moment. The price of corn dropped 50% your first year back. Tell me a little bit about what was going on.
Well, of course, my family was very happy that I was going to come back to the farm, and luckily, they loaned most of my money that I needed to start farming, so they weren't about to foreclose on me, unlike many other farmers. And yes, by my second harvest, the price of corn had dropped 50%. The thing is, you got to realize this wasn't the first farm crisis, and there's been many farm crises in our history, going all the way back to the early days of our republic. But after all, you got to think about the Great Depression. My folks quit farming in 1962 because the farm prices were depressed in the 1950s. And then think about the hog crisis of 1998, when hogs got to $8 a hundredweight, and a full weight hog ready for market was only worth $25. And so the way it's really important that you bring this topic up today, because we're really in a farm crisis again, and farmers are inclined to think that it's all their fault. But after all, farming is not just like any other business, which is what Farm Bureau has always said many, many times. So it's really important. There's a lot of farmers today that are losing sleep, or worse, because they're afraid prices might go lower, which they might, and because they might get a call from the banker or a letter calling in their loans or telling them that they won't be refinanced for the next crop. So it's really important to take that burden off of farmers' shoulders that they think it's their fault.
Right. And that was something we saw a lot of in the 1980s. And George, we will talk throughout the hour. There are a number of elements that did spark the farm crisis of the 1980s that are in place right now. So we will talk about those parallels as the hour goes on. But I want to take a look at this history, because that moment in time was so extraordinary. As I mentioned, by the end of the 1980s, 300,000 farmers had defaulted on their loans. It was a crisis for banks on the level of the Great Depression in Iowa. So as you were struggling as a farmer yourself, can you tell me what you were seeing around you with your neighbors and other farmers in the state that really galvanized you?
Well, the thing is, you know, a lot of farmers are reluctant to talk about their own financial problems because, like I said, they tend to blame themselves and they think other people are going to blame them for making bad decisions. So it took a long time before people actually were willing to share their stories and situations. The thing is that it's not just that people weren't able to pay their payments on their loans. It got to the point where there were so many farm sales that the value of their collateral, whether it was machinery or livestock or land, became so low that the bank said, "Well, you've got more borrowed than your collateral is worth, so therefore we're calling in your loan," even though they had not missed a payment.
Right. So these were farmers that were keeping up, that were doing everything that they needed to do, and they still were getting foreclosed on.
Right. And one of the classic remedies for farmers' financial problems is to produce more. So they would get advice from Iowa State University and the banks to, get some more cows, you know, buy a piece of land, renovate your barn so that you could put more cattle in there or more hogs or whatever. And then it turned out, prices just kept getting worse. And so now those were some of the worst decisions anybody could have made. And they did it in good faith, produce more. So I have more to sell. But there was a lot of weird things going on, including whether the letter they got from the bank was sent to them only because that banker was actually hoping to get those farmers out of business so that they could rent that land to one of their other borrowers, whether it was some crony or some buddy that they needed to bail out more in a more important way than the farmer that was getting the letter. So there was a lot of weird stuff going on and a lot of resentment.
Well, and the personal toll that this took, not just foreclosure, but we saw the divorce rate increase in Iowa. The suicide rate among farmers increased fourfold during the farm crisis. We also saw farmers who, it feels like the ultimate irony, who didn't have enough to eat. Farmers and their families who needed to depend on food aid.
Yes. And I remember talking to farmers who said they ate hamburger three times a day and hardly anything else because that's all they had to eat. They, you know, butchered a cow at some point and they had beef, but they didn't have anything else. They couldn't buy anything else. The FMHA would tie up the checks from the elevator or the milk check, and so they had no cash whatsoever. Yeah, so man, it was crazy. What can I say?
Right. Yeah. As an activist yourself, and you've continued to farm, what have your goals been? What have you tried to change so that farmers don't have to go through this again?
Well, I think people need to understand that the kind of agriculture we're looking at today and the crisis that we're facing today is all a result of simple economics. I would like, you know, people to think about a living wage or a minimum wage. We haven't increased the minimum wage for 10 years now. So you can imagine that if anybody's down at that level of earnings, their lives have had to change in order to make ends meet. Well, it's the same way with farmers. When farmers' prices do not keep up with inflation, their income is actually going down, and that means there'll be fewer farmers that can make a living on the farm. And the remaining farmers are going to think that they're going to farm more acres and try to increase yields, and many times go in debt to do that. So we see the environment being destroyed because all we plant is corn and soybeans now. That creates cheap feed for these big confinements and feedlots that where the livestock's not even owned by the farmer anymore. And the soil is going down hillsides because we're raising corn and soybeans on hillsides that should have been in hay and pasture.
Well, George...
And it's all a result of policy that did not stick with the lessons of the New Deal, of the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl, so that farm prices would actually increase with inflation.
Well, George, we are out of time, but yeah, thank you so much for sharing your experience and your work as an advocate and an activist. George Naylor is a farmer who lives near Tredan, Iowa, on his family's Century Farm. And we're going out to our break here with a little bit of music from Farm Aid Live back from the 80s. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa Week continues today as we explore the question, is this home? This hour, we're talking about what it's like when home no longer feels like home, an experience many farmers and others had during the farm crisis of the 1980s. By the end of that decade, 300,000 farmers had defaulted on their loans. In 1983, there was an average of 500 public farm auctions per month. If you lived in Iowa during that time, you might remember that people drove around with bumper stickers on their cars that said, "The last one out of Iowa, please turn out the lights." If you have memories from the farm crisis that you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can also email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Pamela Riney-Kerberg is a professor of history at Iowa State University. She has been reading hundreds of letters from Iowa farmers sent to Iowa Governor Terry Branstad during the farm crisis. She's working on writing a book right now, tentative title, When a Dream Dies, Agriculture, Identity, and the Farm Crisis of the 1980s. And she is with us now. Hello, Pam.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, I am very glad to be here.
Also with us, Paul Lasley, professor of sociology at Iowa State University and co-investigator of the Iowa Farm and Rural Life Poll. And Paul, thank you for being here. You actually started your work in 1981. That was the dawn of the farm crisis, right?
Yeah. let me make it clear that I came to Iowa in 81. I did not bring the crisis with me.
No, no one blames you, Paul. So, Pamela, we started the hour with these letters from Iowa farmers, and I know that that's a treasure trove that you've been digging into. Tell me a little bit about this collection of letters.
Well, it's all part of Terry Branstad's Governor's Collection. They're housed down at the State Historical Society of Iowa in Des Moines. They're a little bit hard to find because Governor Branstad's collection has yet to be processed. And so with the help of the wonderful archivists there, we've been digging through and finding these letters. And there are hundreds, maybe thousands of them. I haven't even found all of them yet. And they range from letters, you know, saying I'm about to lose my farm, to letters saying I have no sympathy with these people who are about to lose their farms. So it's quite an amazing collection.
Well, and it paints, I'm sure, an extraordinary personal picture of the farm crisis. Have you been surprised by just the amount of letters and some of the things you've been reading?
The amount has been incredible. What's even more amazing to me is just how brutally honest these letters are and how they paint a picture. And, you know, there's one letter in particular I think of where I can just see the woman sitting there at 4 a.m. She doesn't say it's 4 a.m, but I can tell it's 4 a.m. And she's writing this letter to the governor, and she starts out fairly coherent and between the lines. And by the time she gets to the last page, she's writing in 3-inch high letters, help, help, help. And it's quite a moving experience to read how deep this crisis was for individual families.
Absolutely. And before we start exploring that part of the farm crisis, Paul, I want you to help us understand what was going on. George gave us a little bit of an idea of what was going on in the late 1970s that set us up for this crisis. But give us the elements that came together to create this problem.
Well, there are a number of contributing factors that set us up for this. In the 1970s, there was lots of concern about global hunger. In fact, Iowa State University hosted the World Food Conference. The Club of Rome had met, projecting widespread hunger across the world. Our economy was in hyperinflation because we had a fiscal policy that essentially rewarded people being in debt by having fixed interest rates and high inflation. It made sense to be in debt, not only farmers, but everyone that was borrowing money at the time. You could borrow money at relatively low fixed rates and with hyperinflation. It was in the 1979 then that several things came about. Actually, in the late 70s, the Soviet Union came to this country and bought up all of our surplus stocks. Some people have talked about that. In fact, there's a number of books about the grain trade with Russia and how we woke up one morning and discovered that the bin was now empty, and that spiked prices. Earl Butz was Secretary of Agriculture at the time, went across the nation encouraging farmers to expand. In fact, the famous line from many of his stump speeches were plant fence row to fence row. Farmers responded. It was in 1979 that Paul Volcker, who was chair of the Federal Reserve Board and trying to get a handle on this hyperinflation, deregulated interest rates, and almost overnight, interest rates skyrocketed from very low fixed rates to hyper expense. So we mentioned at the start of this program in 1981. It took a couple of years for this to be realized, but I moved to Ames, Iowa in 1981. Home mortgage rates were 17%. And farmers were paying 15% to 20% on operating loans, where they had been paying 3% to 5%. So the change in fiscal policy to break the back of inflation then suddenly penalized everybody that had debt. And that then triggers, not only do we have then farmers that had expanded in response to global food hunger and was encouraged to expand, taking on more debt, and suddenly debt became a very serious liability, especially for those who had expanded or beginning young farmers. In the early days, there was not recognition that this was a crisis. In fact, there was a lot of denial, not only in Iowa, but across the country. I remember giving talks about what I seen as an impending farm crisis. I was chastised by various groups and circles of being an alarmist, being a hillbilly from Missouri that didn't understand modern economics. I mean, you know, I have some of those letters that where I was accused of ringing the alarm bell when there really wasn't a crisis. But in fairness, it did start off sort of as a I oftentimes compare it to a snowball effect. It started off small, but as it picked up speed, it began to endanger not only the financial solvency of banks. We had a number of banks that went under during that period of time, but the ripple effect that spread across the countryside on main streets and in business and industry. And so it was a crisis, but slow in being recognized. George Naylor talked about this sense of shame and blaming, and there was certainly lots of finger pointing as to who was responsible and why, and the slow response of the federal government. And some people, you know, would point back to Jimmy Carter and the grain embargoes.
Right, the grain embargo in 1979, that is something that people bring up a lot.
Yeah.
When he said we're no longer selling grain to the Soviet Union.
Right, right. So there's not a single factor. There were multiple factors that came into play that led to probably the worst financial crisis since the 1930s. Many of the parallels, and I should let Pam talk about that, but the parallels between the hungry 30s and the Dust Bowl days and the forced migration as people left the farms in search of better opportunities. But there's lots of parallels between the 1930s and the 1980s.
Well, and Pam, you have researched a number of things that happened in the 1930s. When you're reading these letters and doing this research, do you find those parallels?
I do. And actually, one of the parallels that has really struck me this week, I've been working on my first chapter, is that in terms of the crash, I see what happened in 1915 to 1919 as enormously similar, because during World War I, American farmers were encouraged to grow as much as they possibly could in order to beat the Central Powers. And they expanded on the basis of debt. And then along came the end of the war, the markets in Europe vanished, and all of a sudden farmers were left with the debts they could not pay. And by the time farmers got to the late 1970s, they were carrying roughly the same ratio of debts to assets as farmers had been carrying during the 1915 to 1919 period. And in both cases, it was a disaster. Mm-hmm. You know, for Iowa farmers, the Great Depression began in 1920. It didn't begin in 1929. It began in 1920. And we see a lot of the same sorts of problems occurring in the transition from the 70s to the 80s. And farmers, again, are holding this enormous debt burden that they can't carry.
You are looking at the years from the late 70s to the early 90s. We call this the farm crisis of the 1980s.
Right.
But this was a long, long decade in Iowa, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It's hard to say exactly when all of this started. Farmers started noticing there was something going wrong in about 1977. And then I don't think that, I'm not sure it ever really winds down completely. I'm cutting off my story in 1993 with the floods. But actually, I had a discussion with Professor Lasley about a year ago, and he said that what we needed to think of it was the situation went from crisis to chronic. It's hard to tell when all of this ended.
Pam, go on, Paul.
Well, normally, yeah, and Pam, you're exactly right. You know, we talk about a crisis as something of short duration and high intensity, and what we've seen for most of that decade, there were some fluctuations, but the chronic nature, long term, as people, and you know, on the adjustment. So some people talk about it as a restructuring, economic, financial restructuring. People would. Some people went out of business, others got loan forgiveness, some were able to renegotiate their loans, but it wasn't tidy.
No, and the stress level was enormous across that whole decade.
Yeah. Well, and Pam, I want to dig into that a little bit because, you know, we call this the farm crisis, but there was a serious mental health crisis.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about why this was so hard for farmers and why we were so ill-equipped to deal with the mental health needs of these families.
It was horrible for farmers because, you know, anytime someone loses a job, that's hard. When someone loses their business, that's hard. An awful lot of these farmers were part of family businesses that extended back for generations and that they hope would extend forward for generations. And they were losing the legacy that their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents had left to them, and losing the future that they hoped their children would have. And so this was a horrible situation for them. But farmers tend to be on the stoic side, and they don't like to talk about their problems. And so getting them to do something constructive rather than sink into horrible depression or potentially kill themselves was very difficult. And the very clever thing that I saw both Extension and Farm magazines doing was essentially setting up do-it-yourself mental health programs. And they would come up with pamphlet series, articles, workbooks, because farmers didn't want to go into town and park outside the clinic where someone might see their truck and might realize that they were getting help for a mental health problem. And so these do-it-yourself programs were really important. What I also saw was people in Extension, people like Dr. Lasley, who really weren't trained in mental health, but were essentially providing mental health services or referring people for mental health services, because farmers would talk. Well, not all of them, but most of them would talk to Extension people, but they might not talk to mental health professionals.
Yeah, so, Paul, do you want to share some of your experiences with that?
Well, and Pam is exactly right. We were ill prepared to deal with this deluge of emotionally distraught people. It wasn't just me. You know, I was part of a much larger team across the state that we provided help and assistance to the mental health centers around the state. But we also found ourselves being service providers in some cases, and as Pam mentions, the reluctance to come forward, the stigma associated with not only the financial side, but now the emotional side. And so there was a program here at Iowa State called the ASSIST program. So we had faculty and staff from Family and Consumer Sciences and from the College of Agriculture. And we spread across the state. We provided FinPAC analysis, financial analysis. We hired a group of farm consultants that could go out and help people get a better handle on sort of where they're at financially and what strategies that they might use to improve cash flow and reduce the expenses and try to make adjustments. Both the Farm Unity Coalition and Iowa State University had hotlines, the Rural Concern Hotline, which is still in existence, provided confidential referral service so that folks could call in and our trained operators could refer people to their local mental health agency. And one of the things that we oftentimes found to avoid being seen in the local, sometimes we would refer clients across county lines.
So their neighbors wouldn't recognize their truck.
Yeah. And so there were there, but it was a horrible time. It was a horrible time. And I think we all were stressed out.
We're going to take another short break here. I'm talking with Paul Lasley, professor of sociology at Iowa State University and co-investigator of the Iowa Farm and Rural Life Poll. Pamela Riney-Kerberg, professor of history at Iowa State University. She has been reading hundreds of letters that Iowa farmers sent to Iowa Governor Terry Branstad during the farm crisis. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa Week continues today. We're exploring the question, is this home, all week long in a number of different ways. In this hour, we're talking about what it's like when home no longer feels like home, which is an experience many farmers and others had during the farm crisis of the 1980s. With me, Pamela Riney-Kerberg, a professor of history at Iowa State University. She's been researching the farm crisis and reading hundreds of letters from Iowa farmers sent to then-Iowa Governor Terry Branstad during the farm crisis. She's writing a book that is tentatively titled When a Dream Dies, Agriculture Identity and the Farm Crisis of the 1980s. Paul Lasley is also with us, a professor of sociology at Iowa State University, co-investigator of the Iowa Farm and Rural Life Poll, and experienced the farm crisis here in Iowa, working with farmers all over the state. You're welcome to join the conversation as well with your experiences, your memories, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Nancy is on the line. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
And this is something that your family experienced. Your family lost their farm during the crisis. Can you tell me what happened?
Yes. My parents were farmers from about the late 1960s, so they didn't inherit land. They bought it in Northwest Iowa. And all I was hearing was just eerily familiar on the show. My father expanded. He bought land, took out tons of loans, I'm sure, in the late 70s, and then things started to tank. He was a hog farmer and raised corn. And he was one of the early ones that the bank started to foreclose. I think it was 81 or 82. And my parents did not know their legal rights because it was at the time when there just wasn't a ton of education going on. They were deeply ashamed. And, you know, I'm sure many in the community thought it was my father's fault. My parents thought it was their fault. They couldn't pay their heat and light bill. They ended up selling. Well, I'm not sure they sold. They moved to town. They ended up getting divorced. Some of the things that the sociologist talked about were just check, check, check. And I often thought that a lot of it was because they were in the early days, and there just wasn't the education, and there wasn't the help at that time until a little bit later, thank goodness.
Wow. And so did you talk to your parents about what that was like, or was that something that they couldn't really talk about?
I'm not sure they could talk about it. And I was in college. And so I was very busy at other things. I just knew it was deeply disturbing. And my father developed a problem with alcohol. I mean, you know, all sorts of things in terms of an inability to cope. And the bank started to send notices. And like I say, at one point, they couldn't pay their heat. My mother didn't know what to do. And at one point, they did see an attorney in Omaha about what their legal rights were, but by that time, they were so far down that I'm not sure they could get back up. And again, there just weren't, I don't think, the resources that early. I think the timing was unfortunate for them because they just didn't know what to do, nor was there the education about what they could do.
Right. How did it affect them in the years after that, from your perspective?
Well, several years later, they got a divorce. My father ended up going to a whole nother field that he had been in before he had become a farmer. Both of them grew up on farms in South Dakota, so the lifestyle was not foreign to them by any stretch, and that's what they wanted to do. My mother ended up going back to school, and we no longer live or have many ties in that area. We don't have the land, and so it was very difficult, and it was difficult for us as kids, even young adults, and I'm sure many ways it was devastating for them. They didn't talk about it for a long time, and that's where I think the sense of shame and embarrassment, and not really understanding that there were outside factors outside of their control. And again, I keep saying there just wasn't, I think, the education or it wasn't as widely known at that time until so many others ended up in that same situation.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for sharing your family's experience with us. And Paul, I mean, that resonates with everything you've been saying. People were ashamed. They were embarrassed. They blamed themselves. I can imagine that within a lot of families, they just didn't talk about the money. Somebody was supposed to be handling that, and then it came as a real shock.
Yeah. Yeah, Nancy's story rings true in so many levels. One of the themes that I developed during this period of time is saving the family farm. Oftentimes, families would make such drastic measures to make the farm payment that by cutting back on various strategies, that the family would fall apart. And Nancy talked about her parents divorced. And unfortunately, that was very common. Because one of the ways that people tried to make ends meet in the 80s was the taking off farm jobs. And so multiple job holding. So both husband and wife working part-time or in some cases full-time off the farm to make the farm payment. But as a result, they grew apart. The stress was so great. There's only so much stress you can undergo for a long period of time. And she mentioned alcohol and drug abuse became rampant as people self-medicated to sort of drown their anxiety, their depression. This was common. Tragically, it was a common way for stoic people that had always been raised with the pride of independence and not to show emotions, to suddenly find that how humiliating that you can't even make the electric bill or the gas bill to keep your home. And you mentioned farm families who made their living producing food, turning to food stamps and government aid because they couldn't make enough money. And many times it was a case of all the money they made, they went to try to save the farm. So we save the farm and lose the family.
Yeah. And Pam, you're, of course, digging into people's personal stories. You've also done some interviews with people who lived through this crisis, and now they've got decades, of course, to reflect on what happened. What kinds of things are you discovering now?
Some of the most, the woman you just talked to was young when all of this was going on. One of the most interesting things I've discovered is that it did have a long impact on young people's lives. I interviewed a person who's now a graduate student at Iowa State who's wasn't a farm child, but her father was trying to find work in Boone, which was suffering greatly because of what was happening on farms. And, you know, her predominant memories of that decade are standing in line to get free government commodities. The government gave away free cheese and other food to people who were in desperate need. And one of her greatest memories of those years is standing in line for food aid. I interviewed another young woman who was a yearbook editor over in Harlan, and they produced in 1985 a farm crisis yearbook. It was having such an effect on their community that they didn't want their yearbook just to be about the football team winning. They wanted it to be about what was really happening in their community. And it's page after page of heartbreak. And her response to some of the pressures of the decade was to go away to college, get a portable career, and she now lives in Portland, Maine. An awful lot of young Iowans really felt the hurt of that decade, and part of the way that they dealt with it was by leaving the state.
Right. And the impact of the farm crisis, of course, didn't stay on the farm. And Paul, we've already touched on that a little bit. But we saw, of course, the banks. Many banks went under during these years. Many main streets just cleared out. Business after business went under. And, of course, with that went the jobs that many farmers were working off the farm. So, I mean, the repercussions just kept going, right?
Well, yes, and I think many of our communities today have still not rebounded from that loss of out-migration, especially of young people. The people that were most vulnerable in the farm crisis were young people that had just got started. They got sort of started in the go-go 70s. They were the most vulnerable. They had the least
security.
And so as a result, but what happened, we lost an entire generation of young farmers. But then there was the other piece of discouraging young people from entering farming. And so the pick up on Pam's theme, not only did we lose some that started farming, but we discouraged young people from going into farming. It sent them off to school and hope that they could get a job in urban America. Sometimes it was in Iowa, but oftentimes it was the out-migration. And so the out-migration, so many of these small communities have never recovered. Yeah. It's not, you know, if you think back 30 years ago in the midst of the farm crisis, or 40 years ago, the young people that left would be middle-aged, could be community leaders. They would have put down roots, and they would have opened businesses and had jobs and raised children. And you could spin off a whole different scenario of what the nature of small towns might have looked like had we been able to retain this entire generation that either was forced out of farming
or
discouraged from going into farming. And you know, over the years, as I've taught here at Iowa State, the number of young people who said their hope and dream was to go back and farm, but their parents said, there's no opportunity for you on this farm. Get an education, get a job in town.
I want to get back to the phones. Chris is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. How are you doing today?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I just noticed one of the pieces that is missing is the black farmer. He was my grandfather, but I called him Dad because he raised me. But he had a farm back home in Sioux City. And he bought that farm back in 1963, which is pretty much unheard of back in them days as a black man even buying land. And so that's the, he ended up having to sell the land before he passed away. It was in the, I want to say mid 80s when he sold it because of what was happening, what was going on and everything. But to my knowledge, he was one, especially around in Sioux City, he was the only black farmer that we even knew of in Sioux City. And so I'm pretty sure there wasn't a whole lot of black farmers even in Iowa, let alone in Sioux City.
Right, and I can imagine for him that was even more devastating given what buying land meant to him to then lose it in the 80s.
Yes, and the land that who he bought the land from back then was, they were friends of his that he bought the land from. And the people that sold him the land, they caught hell because because of the racism and the discrimination that still goes on today. It was really going on back then. The people that he bought the land from, they didn't care about the color of his skin. They liked him as a human being.
Yeah.
And so that's why they sold him the farm, because they liked him. And
right.
It had nothing to, but he then, and that's just one story. We used to live in the suburb of Greenville, back home in Sioux City, and then we moved from there out to Morningside. And when we moved out to Morningside, well, we caught a little bit of hell when we moved to Morningside because we weren't welcomed out in Morningside. And so, and we were only one of, I think, maybe three black families at that time in out there in Morningside. And so they showed us real quick that we really weren't wanted there.
Yeah. Chris,
so we still stayed there.
Yeah. Chris, I'm sorry, we are out of time, but thank you so much for sharing your story and your perspective, one that we don't hear a lot of and is such an important perspective to hear. Thank you for that. And we only have a couple of minutes left. We've talked about how the repercussions of the farm crisis continue today. And Paul, I do need to ask you, Gary Naylor brought it up at the beginning of the show. He said, we've got a lot of the same conditions, or George Naylor, a lot of the same conditions right now that we had in the late 1970s. Do you hear a lot of farmers drawing parallels and saying that they're scared?
There are indications of considerable financial stress. Again, it's a kind of a difficult to get a good read on it. Farmers have got a lot of equity in their farms. They got their farms paid for, their machinery paid for, even though prices are not good, and we've had some market disruptions with tariffs on China and one thing and another. Some farmers will quietly tell you they're doing fine. Their cost of production is relatively low. They can still make money at today's prices. But farmers that are paying high cash rent or have big farm payments or machinery payments, they're experiencing financial stress. It's, you know, so in aggregate, things may look much different than when you start talking about individual groups of farmers. And so over the past year or so, I have talked about the need to be cautious. The only thing that's helping us right now is interest rates are relatively low, especially when you come back to the 1980s.
Right.
But farm prices are low, and unless we see some dramatic changes on international trade, the prospects of a rebound on markets is not very great. This year has been particularly difficult because we've had such abnormal weather patterns, and we have some places where yields are going to be down, and so low yields and low prices, that's a real problem.
Yeah. Paul Lasley, thank you so much. Paul Lasley, professor of sociology at Iowa State University. Pamela Reiney-Kerberg, thank you so much.
Oh, you are very welcome.
I can't wait to read your book, and we'll definitely have you back and dig into so many of these personal stories. Good luck with the writing.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Pamela Reiney-Kerberg is a professor of history at Iowa State University. She's presently writing a book about the farm crisis and digging into hundreds of letters from Iowa farmers sent to Iowa Governor Terry Branstad. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Iowa Week continues. Tomorrow we'll talk about raising first-generation Iowans. I'm Charity Nebbe.